Hey, thanks for tuning in to episode 11 of Unlimited Hangout. I'm your host, Whitney Webb. About a month ago, Johnny Vetmore and I published an article on Unlimited Hangout about the World Economic Forum's first major simulation following their controversial Event 201. This event was known as Cyberpolygon. It was co-hosted by the Forum and a subsidiary of Russia's largest bank, Sberbank, and it simulated a cyber attack targeting specifically private and central banks, an event that, if it came to pass, would likely bring the global financial system to a grinding halt and facilitate the introduction of a completely new digital system. Such an event would certainly benefit the simulation's co-sponsor, Sberbank, which is set to become the first major bank in the world to issue its own cryptocurrency stablecoin and an associated financial ecosystem that will allow them to monopolize payments for daily services throughout Russia. Their system is set to launch sometime in March, which is, of course, just weeks away. Aside from the ever-growing possibility of a great financial reset, in the United States, we have the growing specter of a war on domestic terror that has been designed and is set to be implemented by the very same people that lied the country into a disastrous and deadly war on terror, a war that was clearly, in retrospect, always intended to be a global war of terror. On the quickly escalating domestic terror front, most recently, we've seen a pre-crime arrest related to January 6th that was based only on social media posts. Mainstream media claims that the so-called riot has now inspired Al-Qaeda and ISIS to work with alleged U.S. extremists, and that FEMA has now been tasked by the Biden administration as the latest agency to turn the bulk of their focus and funding to combating domestic terrorism. To discuss the latest developments in the apparently imminent collapse of the financial system and the parallel collapse of personal freedom and the right to dissent in the United States, I am joined today by Charlie Robinson. Some of you may remember Charlie from episode 2 of this podcast. He is the host of the Macroaggressions podcast, which you can find on Rockfin, just like this podcast, by searching for the Macroaggressions channel, and his podcast is also available on other podcasting platforms. Charlie is also the co-author of the new book, The Controlled Demolition of the American Empire, co-written with Jeff Berwick of The Dollar Vigilante. Thanks for coming back on, Charlie. So how are you doing in these crazy times?
I'm doing great, all things considered. It seems like we've had a, you know, in the last year since we've talked, the wheels have come off. I've been disappointed at the response of the American public to just roll over and give up. To trade away their freedoms for some false sense of security. I'd like to say I had hope that things wouldn't turn out this way, but over the last 10 years or so, we've watched this erosion of our civil liberties. We've watched people outsource their critical thinking to the mainstream media and politicians and just say, oh, this world is so complicated. You tell me what to think. You tell me how to act. You tell me what's right for me to do. And it, you know, culminating in 2020 where people couldn't, you know, the question was not, do these masks work? Or it's how many of these masks do you want us to put on? I mean, it was for a country that prides itself on being tough and about freedoms and personal responsibility. I mean, all that went right out the window the first time they were threatened with the possibility of getting sick.
You know, it's interesting. I don't know if this video was from the U.S. or not, but recently on social media, there was a video of a guy that literally just stood out of the side of some random store with a lint roller. And he started telling people that in order to go inside, they had to like hold their arms out and let him pass the lint roller over their clothes. And literally everyone that comes up, he doesn't even have to tell them. They just put their arms out and let them do it. It's really wild to watch. Like, no one is like, wait, that's a lint roller, not a metal detector or something like that. Like,
this is where we're headed. This is what GMO foods, fluoride in the water, and a lifetime of television will get you. It just brainwashes you, right? So you're a compliant sheep. And I hate to say it too, because I'm an American. I still live in America. I want what's best for America. But if I'm being objective and if I'm being honest, I've been extremely disappointed at the response of the people. Now, I expect this sort of stuff from the government and the media. It's what they do. But I have lost so much respect for the general public because, you know, I feel like when these heroes are presented to us out of the, you know, in March of 2020, all of a sudden Fauci steps forward. Deborah Birx steps forward. These people that the vast majority of Americans have never even heard of before. And instantly, they just bow down to them because their television tells them to, because their media tells them to. This is an expert. You're not an expert. How dare you question this expert here? And what you find is, with 2 minutes of digging, this so-called expert has a lot of people that are questioning him, a lot of very smart people that have problems with what he's talking about.
Or they have really obvious conflicts of interest.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Doesn't take a lot of work.
Yeah, massive conflicts of interest, too. And as Americans, we used to look at conflicts of interest differently than we do now. Now we just go, oh, that's just government. Well, this guy worked for Lockheed Martin. Now he's going to be the Secretary of Defense. Well, that's just the way it is. No. No, that shouldn't be the way it is. We should stand up and say, we need to change these things. We need to hold these people accountable. Hang on, we have some questions. But it's become a monologue from the government and the media towards us, not a dialogue. We don't get to question them. We don't get to have the conversation with them. They tell us what to do, and we don't get to ask any questions back. So if we do, we get circled back to, you know what I mean? So
yeah, totally. Well, hopefully, and you know, as the situation gets more extreme, maybe we'll see some more people snap out of it and start to question what's going on to an extent. Well, especially with some things, you know, it's getting harder to hide the various scams that have been going on under the guise of COVID over the past year or so. So, you know, hopefully someone will be able to present data in such a way that even normies will be like, oh, yeah, those numbers don't make sense. And we were lied to last year and things like that. So, you know,
I hope so. There is always the hope that people will snap out of it. Maybe we just aren't at our breaking point. Maybe that line in the sand hasn't been drawn yet. So whatever it is, hopefully Americans get back to being a little bit more skeptical of their government. A little bit more skeptical of the media. Of course, you've done great work on the big pharma and their role and things. I mean, for people to blindly trust the pharmaceutical industry is insane.
It is. And they've been giving total liability on the vaccine, too. So they have zero incentive, even from a business perspective, to make sure the vaccine is safe and effective. And if you look at a lot of the studies that have been done, supposed safety trials and things like that, I mean, none of them have actually been completed. They're all based on preliminary results. The FDA hasn't actually officially approved the vaccines, only via emergency use approval, but they're being marketed as though they were actually approved by the FDA. And it's really wild. And a lot of these vaccine trials didn't use a saline placebo. They used another vaccine, like Pfizer's meningitis vaccine, that is associated with like a slew of side effects. So that effectively masks, you know, any sort of side effects that these, newer vaccines may have. And, you know, none of that has been the subject of really any critical reporting. There was the exception of NPR actually getting around to report on the shady nature of the vaccine contracts awarded to the U.S. government, how they were heavily redacted. They were handed out by a subsidiary of Answer, the dark winter think tank, and stuff like that. Yeah, but, you know, this was a few months ago. But it's amazing just how coordinated the propaganda effort for the vaccine is. And I think that's not just, you know, exclusive to the vaccine. You know, there's a couple other things that have been, you know, targeted in that way, including the domestic terror narrative and some of these other narratives that we've been hearing about, ad nauseum.
And the inclusion of the social media platforms in this suppression campaign of information, because like you said, any of those things about the vaccine, yeah, you know what I mean? So.
Well, one of the things we've been hearing a lot about recently is a lot about different financial things like digital currencies, for example, in a way that haven't been covered recently either, and a lot of interesting events with that. First off, I want to start about talking about the financial system. So in your recent book, you and Jeff Berwick discuss how the collapse of the American empire mirrors the controlled collapse of a building, with one of the key systems targeted for controlled collapse being the global financial system, specifically currencies. So others have been highlighting the state of currency is something to definitely pay attention to. So, for example, I spoke to Catherine Austin Fitz a couple weeks ago, and she recently released a report about the coming end of currencies as we've known them. And you've spoken about how debasing currency is a key way to bring about the collapse of the American and, by extension, the global financial system, since the U.S. dollar is still the global reserve currency. And, of course, the American financial system is critical to the project of American empire, including military expansion and all the bases abroad, among other things. So given the dramatic uptick that we've seen recently in money printing and also the ballooning of debt in the U.S. and globally in the past year because of COVID and related issues, how do you see this situation developing?
Oh, it's a mess, and it's an intentional mess. And we, Jeff Berwick and I wrote this book, and when we laid out the framework of it, it came from a conversation I had with Jeff when he said, you know, it's all coming down. And I said, what do you mean? Elaborate. And he says, the whole system, like the financial systems, the house of cards, the way the governments are set up, it all seems so stable, but it's coming down. So in my head, when I hear coming down, I'm thinking like a building, like a controlled demolition of a building. So I said, Jeff, what if we did, what if we made the comparison between the way you would take down an actual building, you know, pre-weakening the building, identifying the support columns, rigging the detonators, ringing the alarm bells, pushing down the plungers, clearing the debris. What if we took that and compared it to the way the empires come down? And so when we got to the part about rigging the detonators, that's where we got into central banks, debt, quantitative easing to infinity, and all of the manipulation of the currency that they do. I listened to your interview with Catherine Austin Fitz. She is the best. I've written two books. I've got chapters about her in both books. So I mean, I'm a fan, and I think that she sees things from an angle that most people can't because of her extensive work with Dylan Reed and co. So I like what, you know, she's talking about the end of currencies. That's hard to comprehend for us. But mm-hmm. when we looked back, when Jeff and I, we started the book by looking back on previous empires. And one of the things that you see a very predictable pattern. And when you get to that, there's eight stages of empire. You get to that last stage, and where we are in the American empire, it is undeniable. We are on the eighth stage. Nobody can deny that. One of the things that, say, the Roman Empire did that was fascinating to me was they would take their gold coins as things were expanding beyond belief. Their empire was as big as it had ever been. Their army was massive. It was unsustainable. Searching for wars to get into. They started to debase their own currency. Now they did it by taking the coins and clipping little pizza slice sections out of the edges of all of the coins, collecting all those pieces together, melting them down, and making a new coin. Or changing the content of the metals in order to debase it. So they, you know, the Fed learned from the Romans. You know, I mean, there's a pattern you get to when you grow this massive empire. At some point you can't afford it anymore. So you look at, you're in control of the money supply. You say, well, I'm in control of the money supply. I just print more money. Nobody will know. Except they always kill the goose that lays the golden egg. There's something in our psyche that just makes us take it one step too far. And there's a point at which you've gone too far. And in 2020, what we saw was the creation of almost 40% of the U.S. money supply was created in 2020. I mean, no wonder
that's
Bitcoin
so
was
mental.
Going through the roof. I mean, this is a recipe for disaster. If I didn't know any better, if Jeff and I, when we were writing this, we were saying, I think they're trying to start hyperinflation. I mean, it's the only explanation for this. It seems like they're trying to kickstart and whittle away this currency in order to force people to make a decision to get out of it and into something else. So this is going to be, in my opinion, a classic problem reaction solution situation.
Right.
Problem. We've got a currency. The US dollar is hyperinflating. Reaction. Oh my God. We've got to find something more stable. Solution. Here's the Fed coin. Now, not Bitcoin, but the Fed coin, you know, some manipulated currency that has a backdoor they call a stable coin. They'll use every sort of trick in the world to make you think that this is stable, but it will be a compromised digital version. And then they'll start the scam over again. So this is a very important component of taking down the American empire. In fact, it's something that when we looked back, you know, we talked about the Roman Empire, and that's so far away. It's kind of hard to make that comparison and in a way that we connect with. But a lot of us can connect to the former Soviet Union, and we saw what happened there. A lot of the same strategies that were used to take that union down were used on us. So you've got an unwinnable war in Afghanistan for 10 years. God, we've doubled that. You've got exterior forces manipulating their currency. That was definitely happening. The Soroses of the world were in there doing that. You have the politicians that were stealing everything that wasn't nailed down, and then privatizing industries and giving it to their buddies, turning them into oligarchs. So All of these things that we saw in the Soviet Union that led to the collapse, the same playbook's being run on us here too, including currency manipulation. So we it's something for us to keep our eyes on. I know it doesn't get a whole lot of, you know, it doesn't get a whole lot of talk because it's, you know, banking is so boring, you know. I mean, it's way more exciting and interesting to talk about wars and things like that. But banking, you know, banking gets a pass because it's just boring white guys with dark suits on Wall Street, and who cares what they're doing, and it's so complicated, and I don't know. But it is so important for us to understand how it works, because
totally
they've used this system to just enslave humanity and create a sort of you know, quality of life here in America that's completely unsustainable unless this Ponzi scheme keeps going. And so it always leads me back to Berwick saying this whole thing's coming down. And he didn't say it in a snarky way. He just said it in sort of a matter of fact way, like it's a math equation, you know. And so that's where we are right now. Who's in charge of the banking? Only the most devious people in the world. What are they doing with it? Well, they're inflating it away at a crazy rate. And they're and under for what? Well, it's under the guise of fighting COVID or, you know, stimulating the economy. But we see through that. It's not stimulating the economy when only Amazon and Best Buy are allowed to be open and all the mom and pop stores are. I mean, that's not what this is. This is a demolition in order to bring in this fourth industrial revolution.
So going back to Fedcoin, I feel like a lot of people misunderstand just how insidious that is, because not only will it allow central banks to continue manipulating the money supply and currency and what have you, but it also, for the first time ever, would allow them to basically turn your money off because of this whole, you know, the whole ecosystem, payment ecosystem they're trying to set up alongside these central bank backed, you know, coins, the Fed coins or whatever you want to call them. But also, you know, as I mentioned earlier, you have Sberbank, Russia's largest private, well, its largest stakeholder is the Russian government, but, you know, it's still technically not fully state-owned, but they're about to introduce their Sbercoin, and that is has the, you know, approval of Russia's central bank, so, you know, some public-private, to an extent, cooperation, and, you know, what's not technically a Fed coin, but definitely isn't something much better or potentially even worse, right?
Yeah.
So one thing that I've heard from you know, I'm not, you know, a crypto expert or anything like that, but I do know a lot of people that are really into crypto and have a lot of knowledge about it. And so, you know, we've heard a lot more about cryptocurrency and Bitcoin recently, even in mainstream media. And so, you know, for most people, based on that reporting, Bitcoin is sort of thought of as, you know, this novel financial technology, you know, sort of a volatile market, or, you know, but a lot of people that are really into Bitcoin don't view it really as that. In my experience, they seem to perceive it more as like a political movement or statement, sort of like as an investment in the irrelevance of central banking, things like that. So I was wondering what your views were, you know, on that, you know, on that viewpoint.
Well, my take on crypto is that it's a lot of the people in that Bitcoin community, I've got to know them at Anarcapulco over the last couple of years, which is the conference in Acapulco, Mexico that Jeff Berwick puts on. It's the largest anarchist convention, cryptocurrency, health and wellness. So I've got a chance to meet a lot of those guys and talk to them about that. And they do see this as not as a bet against the current system. So it's not so much that they're looking at Bitcoin from a financial services standpoint. They're looking at it as, how do I get out of this system? How can I conduct business without the state being involved? How can I do the sorts of things that I want to do without unnecessary government oversight. Oh, and by the way, maybe I can make some money at this at the same time by investing in a coin that there's only going to be 21 million total in circulation. So they play that money supply game. So I think they're coming at it from a couple different angles. They'd love to make money doing it, of course, but it's more, a lot of them see this as a freedom bet and more of a bet against the current paradigm system.
So what do you think about, you know, people, you know, look at this stuff, right? And are like, well, how the heck do I ensure any sort of future financial security in this climate? You know, some people are like, is crypto the only option? You know, what are, do you have any opinions on that?
I think that a lot of people that see crypto as an option also see physical gold and physical silver, something like that, something that is that they can hold, that they can have. I mean, the one component of crypto that makes people nervous is that they can't tangibly hold it. They feel like they can't put it in their hands and bury it in their backyards if they need to. I guess, and technically you can, if you have it in a crypto wallet, you can do that. Mm-hmm. But still there's something psychological about having a gold coin in your hand or having a silver bar in your hand that makes that a little bit more real. And you know that it has value because it's precious. You can exchange it with people on a local level if things go wrong. So, that's something that people are flocking to. They see the dollar as a question mark for the first time in a very long time. I mean, I think they should have been seeing it as a question mark for the last 15 to 20 years, but
yeah.
Most people assume that it's stable. They think that and compared to maybe some of the other currencies around the world, maybe it is a good bet. Maybe it's a better bet than some form of currency in a remote part of Africa. But if you look at the financials of the U.S. dollar, it's a catastrophe. It's just waiting to happen. It's only propped up because of our relationship with the as the world's reserve currency. Our use of the SWIFT banking system keeps a lot of people at check because of that. Our petrodollar arrangement, and let's be honest, the U.S. military backing it. Mm-hmm. So this has kept the dollar relevant for a long time, probably longer than it should have been. But it's changed now. We've gone off of gold. It's not backed by anything but a promise. It's really backed by a threat. So that's when your currency is backed by the threat of the U.S. military, that just doesn't have the same sort of feeling of security than if you have some currency that is backed by the fact that it's a scarce metal or a cryptocurrency that has a maximum capacity of number of units that can ever be created. So I think people see that as a potential safe haven in an environment where there aren't very many safe havens to be had.
Well, the petrodollar is pretty interesting too, because this whole, Great Reset crowd, they're also looking to sort of reset the energy sector in a huge way and basically eliminate oil. And so you have oil in some sense. There's obviously the other things backing the U.S. dollar you mentioned too. But of course, for, since the 70s, a big part of that has been oil. This, announced effort backed by people like Bill Gates, among other billionaires, to move, the world at some point completely off oil. That's going to involve some sort of reset type event probably too. And obviously, if that were to happen, the dollar would obviously be in a sticky situation. So it's definitely, the whole oil market energy aspect to this is something that sort of I think gets overlooked a lot when talking about the whole Great Reset. Specifically its financial component, because people don't see how so much of it is interconnected, like the energy, finance, and some of these other parts.
Yeah. And I wondered when Saudi Aramco went public for $2 trillion, if that wasn't them cashing out before this big Great Reset, because they know that they're in an industry that has been slated for destruction itself by these maniacs at the World Economic Forum. So perhaps they were given the heads up. Hey, listen, we're transitioning to a world without oil. You might want to take your profits off the table at this point. And that could have been a reason for that.
Well, I think, that's part of why the MBS's rise in Saudi Arabia was engineered, because of this recognition that at some point the Saudis would have to embrace a post-oil economy, despite the fact that, a lot of the ways in which they maintain order in Saudi Arabia is through the wealth provided by oil and providing a lot of men in Saudi Arabia cushy state jobs that are all, you know, financed by this. And then you had MBS come in promising to make this new, like, what, smart city or whatever. I don't know what's happened to that. But, you know, that was a few years ago, and talking about all this, you know, data stuff and what have you, having really close ties to Kushner, also having really close ties to Epstein at a time when Epstein was intimately involved, as was Ghislaine Maxwell, and sort of networking with Silicon Valley and things like that. So,
and also their Sophia robot that was rolled out in Saudi Arabia. Ironically, they gave her citizenship, treated her better than they treated the women in their country.
Yeah.
And that Sophia robot was made by Hanson Robotics, which did a deal with Ben Gertzel from Hanson Robotics, took $6.5 million from Epstein to develop the little Sophia doll, the emotional intelligence AI doll for kids. So, there's creepy component as well.
Gertzel never apologized for the Epstein funding, and he is also tied up with another organization that Epstein funded, because Epstein funded Gertzel, but he also funded the organization where I think Gertzel is vice president, or he's number two, which used to be called the World Transhumanist Association, and now is called Humanity Plus. And at Unlimited Hangout, we're going to be having a report soon about how another person at Humanity Plus has been getting tons of money from the National Institutes of Health to, quote unquote, fight the opioid crisis with, like, invasive wearable biometrics to determine when someone who has used opioids in the past appears to have a craving based on biological markers. It will alert the health authorities to come intervene before they can partake and stuff like this.
Oh, great. What could possibly go wrong with that?
I know. It's really mental. But I think, you know, the whole push for, you know, how Biden and Kamala Harris have sort of postured about how they're going to start closing private prisons and they're not going to be sending drug offenders to prison anymore. It looks increasingly like the way they're going to argue to do that is by instead basically putting them under house arrest with these, you know, wearable biometric things that they can use to harvest data off of people. And of course, the amount of people with opioid issues in the U.S. is really staggering. It's only gotten worse under COVID. And a lot of people, you know, having the largest, you know, prison population in the world, if you're going to take out all the nonviolent drug offenders and make them wear that stuff, I mean, that's a huge amount of people that you're suddenly gathering all this biometric data from, you know, in real time, second by second. So, definitely some crazy stuff, and amazing to see these organizations funded by Epstein continuing to be influential and, you know, making this crazy police state panopticon that's, you know, just so next level.
How crazy would it be that the child trafficking component of Epstein's operation turns out to not be the most dangerous? that his work with the scientists might end up being what enslaves humanity. I mean, we thought that the child trafficking was horrible, and it is, of course. But man, his relationship with these scientists, it you know, it's funny. It made me very suspicious, because, you know, it got to the point where everyone was talking about him on the mainstream media with regard to the trafficking component, but they never mentioned anything about his relationships with these scientists. They tried extremely hard to distance him from Bill Gates as well, too.
Well, now the guy that's going to be the top science official in the Biden administration, Eric Lander, he's going to be like a cabinet level official, the new science czar. Was funded by Epstein, and Epstein bragged about funding him on his website. And the New York Times asked him about it, and through a spokesperson, he said, well, it appears that Epstein made this up. So it's not like a flat denial, you know, as opposed to saying, like, no, we didn't get money. It appears, you know, the quote unquote dead guy made it up, you know, so you can't, like, you know, it's just a really silly response, and he hasn't been challenged on it at all. And it's amazing to see how elevated these people have become. But I think the reason for that, and the reason, you know, Epstein was allowed to become a mainstream media figure is because of the focus on the previous sexual blackmail operation. But it's very evident that after Epstein's first arrest and he was sort of outed and it became, you know, clear, at least to people that were paying attention, sort of what was going on there, he and Ghislaine Maxwell both transitioned at the same time, you know, Israel's government was and other, you know, intelligence agencies like in the US and the UK were increasingly relying on electronic forms of blackmail and surveillance as opposed to, you know, necessarily sexual blackmail, because it's cheaper for them. I think, you know, to have a back door and get all of someone's communications and use that as leverage, as opposed to having to, you know, conduct this, you know, child trafficking operation that was, you know, obviously can get some law enforcement attention. And then you have to bring in the management from the FBI to cover everything up and whatever, like this always goes, you know, but that, you know, that's my opinion about that. But the science thing is really fascinating, because most of, not to get too much off topic, but a lot of Epstein's ties to these big tech people was through something called the Edge Foundation. And that was actually a literary agent who's been obsessed with transhumanism for a really long time, since the 60s, John Brockman. And really Edge, you know, which would host this billionaire's dinner, you'd have the Google co-founders, Jeff Bezos, I mean, some of the biggest names, right? Elon Musk also attending all of these dinners. But it turns out from the time of the first billionaire's dinner, 1999, until 2015, Epstein was basically the only donor to Edge. It was basically a front for him. And then the year that he stops donating in 2015, they stop hosting billionaire dinners.
Wow. How convenient.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, talking about Wall Street, a lot of the Wall Street crowd that surrounds Epstein, people like Leon Black, you know, they all started at the same bank in the 1980s, which it's like Drexel. I can't remember the full name of the bank. It's like three names, Lambert something.
Drexel Burnham Lambert.
That's it. Thank you. And anyway, the head of that went to prison, Michael Milken, right? He came back at these Edge billionaire dinners, which were, you know, facilitated by Epstein to rebrand also as a tech investor, which of course Epstein started to do after his first arrest. So
yeah, definitely. Always got to be a philanthropist, right?
Oh man, yeah. But I mean, the corruption of science has been really apparent in the past year, just how easy it is to pay these people off, and you have the right people in elite academia, you know, saying things that aren't actually scientific, and they're towing a particular line or narrative that doesn't actually, you know, reflect the data and things like that, or, you know, the data is being manipulated and all of this stuff. And no one's really brought up the Epstein science fact. Like, have any of these scientists been blackmailed by Epstein? Any of these experts that have been, you know, rolled out, or by the same intelligence agencies that are blackmailing people and things like that? I mean, it's definitely worth considering. But I think, you know, for a lot of these scientists, you know, just money from the Gates Foundation or whatever, you know, billionaire, quote unquote, philanthropic foundation usually is enough. But it makes you wonder, given how that close association with Epstein and a lot of these prominent scientists.
It always made me wonder, too. And this is, to be clear, a speculation on my part. But the relationship that Bill Gates had with Jeffrey Epstein, I'm thinking that in that scenario, Bill Gates has all the money in the world. Jeffrey Epstein has all the blackmail evidence he'll ever need. If you're Bill Gates and you're planning to run this, be a part of this gigantic COVID situation that's going to happen in the future, and you have this relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, why wouldn't you buy a copy of the blackmail files from him against all these scientists and politicians that you may need in the future when you're running this op? Because like you said, it's very interesting how everybody got in line behind Gates and there was no pushback at all. I understand he funds the media heavily, and I do know that the MS and MSNBC stands for Microsoft. So he's always going to be, by default, painted as the good guy just because of the amount of money he throws around. But there was almost zero pushback against Bill Gates, and it made me think that he had the goods on somebody. And if he had the goods, it might have come from Epstein. And like I said, it's speculation, but this relationship – they had a very, Gates said, I would go to Epstein because he had access to people and I knew that I could get money from them for some of my project. That doesn't make any sense to me, because Bill Gates doesn't need the money. He's the guy that gives the money. He's not the guy raising the money. So that didn't ever seem right to me. But a relationship in which they exchanged information for money or whatever, that to me seemed like a relationship that would fit, especially given, if you're Bill Gates and you know what is about to come, you have Event 201 planned, you have all these things in advance of that, you would strengthen yourself. You would put yourself in a position so that nobody could go against you. And that's what I think happened.
Right. Well, you know, one of the reasons there wasn't pushback, well, initially, right, I think Bill Gates said, oh yeah, I met him once. And I think he said like 2016 or something, the New York Times came out and said, aha,
we found a picture of you with him in 2011 being like, I gotcha or whatever. But actually, I reported on this at the end of 2019. There is an article in the UK newspaper, The Evening Standard, from 2001 that lists Epstein's top business partners responsible for his wealth as three people: Leslie Wexner, Donald Trump, who of course we all know about, but the third person's Bill Gates. So that was published in 2001. So obviously there are some intense ties between Epstein and Bill Gates that go back to the 1990s. And we also know that Bill Gates did business with Isabel Maxwell when she was running was the vice president at this internet services company, that she, Christine Maxwell, and their husbands at the time were running, called Magellan. But Ghislaine Maxwell had a huge stake in that, actually. So it wasn't just the sisters, as is usually reported. And a couple years later, Isabel Maxwell starts basically running this a tech company that was created by these ex-IDF guys, you know, as a sort of typical with Israel, you have the military in a lot of cases behind these companies. And she talks about how she basically had Bill Gates wrapped around her finger to some extent. And the Guardian describes her as starting to purr, and she starts talking like a Southern belle, even though her accent's normally British. I mean, she just gets super weird about it. That definitely wasn't covered. That's a 2003 Guardian article on Isabel Maxwell, for those that are interested, because it's a really odd passage to read. But actually, at that time, Paul Allen and Bill Gates had both basically put Comtouch, which was Isabel Maxwell's, this Israeli company at the time, put them on the map, according to Isabel, that they would not have been able to do that. And they were going to go public, have an IPO. And it was actually Paul Allen, his private investment arm, I think it was called Vulcan Ventures or something.
Vulcan Ventures.
Yeah. Basically came in at the last second and rescued the share price of the IPO so it didn't fail, and did all these favors for them at that time, which is pretty interesting. So there's definitely something there. And also during the 1990s, when, you know, these UK newspapers would like follow the Maxwell siblings around and see what they're up to now. What are Captain Bob's children doing now? You know, those kind of stories. Right. Ghislaine would describe herself as an internet operator throughout the 1990s as her official cover story. So it's kind of interesting when you see them rebrand and get really involved with the Silicon Valley stuff. And you also consider that Epstein, sometime between, in 1999, his relationship with this Edge Foundation and these scientists and Silicon Valley figures really got big, but it definitely goes back to 1995, because John Brockman is like the publishing agent for a lot of these big name scientists. So one of his big name scientists, Epstein, funded the book for one of them after the initial publisher rejected the manuscript and some other stuff. So he'd already sort of started there. And in the early 90s, he was already funding Harvard and some of these universities where he cultivated these, you know, science ties, MIT being the other one. And another thing that's really weird, I think you touched on this a little bit earlier, about Gates, is that he funneled his donations to MIT through Epstein. So he didn't give through his very well-known philanthropic foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He has no problem using that foundation to give money to tons of organizations, but he couldn't donate to MIT himself. He had to funnel it through Epstein. And his excuse for that was what you cited earlier, saying, well, he knows a lot of rich people. And I'm like, you know, Bill Gates, aren't you like one of the richest guys in the world and you only hang around rich people? So like, do you really need Epstein to meet the other rich people when you have right. been meeting with them for years and you have that, you know, famous meeting in 2009 about reducing the population with, you know, Ted Turner and Oprah and Michael Bloomberg and all of these people?
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't know rich people. I mean, it's just like the most ludicrous explanation, and he was never held accountable for that or the earlier ties, which I think is very much why they've kept the focus on Epstein in a particular area and not on the broader implications of it, and also why the cases the U.S. government has chosen to bring against, you know, Ghislaine Maxwell recently, you know, it covers a time period in the mid-90s. It's not really, you know, recent by any measure. So it's definitely interesting stuff. So.
Yep. Two guys that you can't trust, Jeffrey Epstein and Bill Gates, working on projects together. I mean, I would say if you're not suspicious of the projects that they're involved in, then you're not paying attention, because those guys, despite what it says on their business card, neither one of those people were philanthropists. They have an agenda that's very dark. We had Epstein financing evolutionary dynamics
at Harvard.
Programs at Harvard. And it's like, what is that? Well, it's like game theory and population control, and what happens if we make a change here? What does that do to the overall population? This is the precursors to eugenics programs. I mean, this is some dark stuff. And when you look into Bill Gates's background, yes, he's this tech nerd guy, but you know, his dad has a dark history of being involved in Planned Parenthood. And I had this conversation with David Icke a couple of months ago, and we were talking about how if you have these two stories, these themes that you've seen over the last 30 years, you've got nerdy freshman at Harvard who starts a transformational technology company with stolen technology and goes on to become a massive billionaire. Bill Gates leaves Harvard after a freshman year, drops out and starts this company. Bill Gates doing that, and Mark Zuckerberg, both part of an agenda. Then the second fake narrative you have is we just developed this tech transformational company in Silicon Valley in our garage. You know, so then you've got the Googles, Hewlett Packards, and David Icke was going, oh my God, I just watched a documentary about that where they took all the garage doors and they took them to this museum and they had all the garage doors and everything. And it's like, they're not very creative.
So no, they're not.
Two narratives, your two versions of these heroes that are these tech guys that are coming to save you. Either they just got lucky in their garage in Silicon Valley or got lucky in their dorm room in Harvard. Pay no attention to the actual funding, where that came from.
It's coming the CIA, from DARPA most places, of the time.
Or Incutel. Mm-hmm. Don't look at that. Don't ever look at that. It's just these guys got lucky. So worship Mark Zuckerberg.
Well, you know, it's interesting when talking about Silicon Valley companies, a lot of people are pretty aware, at least now, that like Google got Incutel funding, Palantir, you know, their CIA ties are even more glaring than Google's to a huge degree. But Facebook has sort of been left out of that. And what's really interesting is that right before Facebook launched, actually, it was the announcement of it being shut down was made the very day that Facebook as a company launched, with Palantir's Peter Thiel as the main investor, by the way,
exactly,
who was already tied up with the CIA to a huge degree. But this program that was shut down right before Facebook came out was analogous to Facebook, and it was run by DARPA. It was an extension of this total information awareness surveillance program that was proposed after 9/11 that was, you know, criticized heavily even by mainstream media. And eventually, you know, had to be shut down by an extension. But all these private equivalents not tied to the government pop up. And of course, they don't look like they're connected to the government. And they're not held accountable. But really, the parallels are stunning. And then you have years, not that long after, you know, like Facebook opens up their like weird Building 8 research facility, and they hire the former head of DARPA to run that, which is a little interesting. And, you know, with this new war on domestic terror that we're facing, we're now having people being arrested, basically pre-crime arrests, because of their violent posts made on Facebook or social media, which is really interesting. And this whole life log thing was meant to have basically a log of every life event and life milestone of a person from birth to the present that could be used basically for the purpose of surveillance, but also profiling people who may dissent or become problematic for the government. Yeah. And where we are now, I mean, it's really obvious to me anyway, that even if Facebook wasn't intentionally set up to be life log, in practice with this new war on domestic terror that has, you know, escalated really quickly after January 6th, it basically is the same thing. It's serving the same purpose, which was, getting people to express their views, making them feel like it's a public forum, and then criminalizing them with it. It's just very alarming, and more reason than any other one. I mean, even more than them censoring, you know, articles and things like that. The whole pre-crime arrest angle of it, I think, is more than enough for people to boycott Facebook.
And then Snowden came forward and started talking about the collection of all of this information. And he was saying it wasn't so much, you know, what really bothered him the most about it was that, let's say you commit, you do something 10 years from now that they catch you on, and then they go back and retroactively go through your history and make a case against you based on who you talk to. And that was the part that was the most alarming. So you, like you said, you get everyone, you open up the town square, Twitter, Facebook, and you invite everybody in, tell them it's, you know, it's free. And this is just, you know, you're just chatting with your friends. And then, like you said, you build up enough of, you gather enough of this information over years and years. You then build a profile of these people. And then if you want to, anytime you want to, you can go in and throw the switch and say, you said something offensive. We're going to come get you. Now, I saw this firsthand on a smaller scale with me on Facebook in 2019. I got put in a 30-day Facebook jail for a post from 2017. I forgot I put it up, and it wasn't even anything big. It was a meme. Then it happened to me three more times in that summer. So in the summer of 2019, I was put in Facebook jail four times for four offenses that all had to do with something said 2 years earlier. And that to me was really frustrating because, you know, you throw your hands up and go, what do you want me to do? Like, what am I supposed to do? You're banning me for stuff I said 2 years ago. How am I supposed to defend myself? Okay, fine. I won't say it again, but this is ridiculous. So the retroactive prosecution of you for thought crimes is coming. And this domestic terrorist component of it is devious and very scary. And I think people maybe are not quite understanding how problematic and how dark this can be. Because when you start hunting domestic terrorism, and then you leave that term kind of vague, you just have to look at history and see what happens when everybody could be a domestic terrorist. Then what do they do? Is this the Khmer Rouge? They start rounding up scientists and doctors and historians and teachers and anybody with a brain, anybody that's wearing glasses. Is that the criteria for now they consider you a domestic terrorist? I mean, it sounds preposterous, but this is what's happened in the past. So we have to sort of look at this and we think, oh, no, America's better than that. They're not going to do that. Really? Have you seen the behavior of Americans over the last year? I don't know how much better we are than that. And the authoritarian component of this that's been rolled out lately is very alarming to me, because what I'm seeing is two things. I'm seeing the police forces not resist at all, just jump right in to this authoritarian role, this role as the brown shirt. And I've seen the American public just throw their hands up and cower and say, tell me what to do. I'll do whatever you want me to do. Just make it all stop. Well, this is a recipe for disaster. And then, so I think that as we get further into this year and we start to hear the term domestic terrorist thrown around a lot more, it's going to be a wake-up call for some people to realize, hang on a second, by this vague classification, I'm a domestic terrorist too. You know, oh, what does that mean? Well, it means that you are subject to be to the will of the state. Whenever they decide that they want to round you up and take you off somewhere and re-educate you, you go, oh, that would never happen here. Well, what do you have to do when you fly into Canada now? You have to test negative for a COVID test in a hotel. And then if you test positive, where do they take you? They take you to a government facility. So this is all, you know, all of us conspiracy theorists out there, we would like an apology, because things that we speculated about, that we told you were coming, and you said, get out of here, this is never going to happen. You're crazy. Look, it's being rolled out now in front of our eyes. So it's something that we have to be aware of.
Well, that's something, you know, that caught my attention when I read that that recent news about the Biden administration having FEMA divert a lot of its focus and funds, not from like natural disasters, despite what's just happened in Texas and like Oregon and major parts of the country. Now they're instead they've been told to focus a lot of their funding and efforts on domestic terrorism, which, you know, as soon as I read that, I hear Alex Jones's voice in my head from years ago screaming about FEMA camps, right? But, you know, it's interesting that, you know, why FEMA for domestic terrorism when you already have the FBI and DHS devoting the majority of their resources per them now to that specific issue? We really need to add FEMA to at a time when, like, there are natural disasters that they should be focusing on instead.
The organization that can't distribute bottled water to people, you want them in charge of the domestic terrorist program?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Well, they're not in charge, but they're going to be playing some role, but it hasn't been, you know, all the roles they're playing haven't been laid out, really. But what's really alarming to me about this war on domestic terror is the role that the Anti-Defamation League is playing in it. If you go back to some of these hearings, like when they basically first announced this war on domestic terrorism, right as COVID hit in front of Congress in March 2020, the FBI talks about how their field offices are basically tipped off about who to investigate as domestic terror threats by the ADL, which is really alarming when you consider that, for example, the ADL was advising the FBI at the time of the assassination of Malcolm X, and Malcolm X was labeled by the ADL as like the worst anti-Semite in America at the time, and things like that. And, you know, aside from that example, you know, over the years, the ADL has been really obvious about the fact that they basically support the prevailing government narrative of Israel's government at any given time. So people that often express, pro-BDS sentiments or support Palestinian rights or things like that often get smeared as anti-Semitic by the ADL. And what's interesting and hasn't been covered that much about the war on domestic terror is that there's actually been this overarching focus on what's anti-Semitic domestic terrorism that, allows them to focus both on people on the left and also on the right. You know, the white supremacists, the neo-Nazis are anti-Semitic, but there's also the anti-Semitic extremist left and things like that. And you have the ADL being one of the key people, despite their conflict of interest with a foreign government. And also their funding from a lot of these quote unquote philanthropist oligarchs who also had all these ties with Epstein. The biggest funders of the Anti-Defamation League for years have been members of this, the mega group, the Bronfman brothers, Leslie Wexner himself, people like that. So it's definitely really alarming to see the involvement of those people coming back to Epstein again, you know, being allowed to basically say to the FBI, investigate this person. And the FBI's like, and we just do it. You know, I mean, that hasn't been covered enough, in my opinion.
Ah, the Anti-Defamation League spends their days out defaming everybody. It's just the irony of it. Yeah, they're a danger. I labeled them a terrorist organization in my book because, yeah. You know, the way they treat people, the way they go around labeling people as anti-Semites or domestic, you know, or whatever label they put on it, because they have some clout. I mean, I don't obviously trust them and you don't trust them, but the vast majority of people see that name and they think, oh, this is what you're about, going after the people that are defaming you. Oh, you're Anti-Defamation League. Great. It couldn't be further from the truth. What mm-hmm. they're doing, is anybody that doesn't, anybody that is critical of Israel's foreign policy, the government of Israel. No, we're not talking about Jewish people. We're not talking about Jews from Israel. We're talking about the government of Israel. Anybody that's critical of them, or like you said, pro BDS or pro Palestinian rights and things like that. Oh, I mean, they're automatically on a list. And think about the irony of that. The Anti-Defamation League, backed by Jewish billionaires, making lists of people to be taken away to camps. How the roles have reversed over the last 75 years.
Yeah, huh? Yeah. Well, it makes a lot of sense when you consider that, you know, the Netanyahu's political party in Israel, Likud, was originally founded by Jabotinsky, who was inspired specifically by Mussolini's style of fascism in the 20s and the 30s, of course, which led, obviously Italy being part of, you know, the baddies in World War II. But, you know, that same ideology that, you know, led to that fascism represented by the Axis powers, you know, is behind also the ruling party of Israel today. So, you know, it's really not that surprising in that sense to see, you know, I mean, if the ruling party in Israel is based along, was inspired by the ethno-fascism of that era, it's not hard to see what happens now. The thing is now that, you know, they have the ADL, so that helps protect them from dissenting opinions by, you know, allowing them to play the victim card and to compare people, you know, to Nazis just for, criticizing their policies and things like that. But, you know, it's not just the FBI, too. Going back to Silicon Valley, Silicon Valley's Hate Lab, which was basically funded into existence by Pierre Omidyar, the eBay founder who also backs The Intercept, that the ADL runs that. It's the ADL Hate Lab, but it's been funded by, you know, the Silicon Valley billionaires to an extent. And, you know, Pierre Omidyar is not Jewish. So, I mean, it's definitely something that, you know, they just sort of defer to them, I guess, or allow them for whatever reason, because of their connections, their funding, their influence, what have you, to have just a hugely outsized role in this war on domestic terror. And that's I really wish this would get more attention, because there are people on the progressive left that are cheering this war on domestic terror on, but they know that the ADL is basically a front for Israel's government. If they've ever run into problems regarding like supporting BDS or something like that on the progressive left. And I think if those people, you know, you could show them how a lot of this, at least at the lower levels, you know, is being dominated in some ways by the Anti-Defamation League. Is it really about, you know, domestic terror? Or is it about dissenting opinions? And, you know, it's obviously going to be a very blurred line if you're having these groups like the ADL intimately involved. And of course, the FBI, too, which is, you know, fundamentally corrupt, and pretty much every big investigation they've ever done has been just a massive cover-up, whether that's, you know, the anthrax attacks, their role in investigating, quote-unquote, investigating 9/11, and, you know, numerous other events throughout the years. You know, it's no coincidence, as I point out in my Epstein series, that some of these people in this, you know, syndicate that are tied to the ADL ended up actually blackmailing J. Edgar Hoover back in the 30s and 40s, largely thanks to the union between U.S. intelligence through Bill Donovan and Mayor Lansky of the Jewish mafia, or the Jewish mob, which was, you know, part of the National Crime Syndicate at the time. So I really wish more people would focus on this particular group in relation to that, because it's not just about the U.S. government, you know, then it looks less like the U.S. government or the Biden administration leading on this, because they're it's definitely a little more complex than that.
Yeah, yeah. This is something that's going to wake a lot of people up. And if you think that you're safe because you are in agreement with the prevailing narrative now, just wait till you have a contradictory thought later in the future. They will come for you too.
Yeah. So one of the things in your book with Jeff Berwick that you talk about needing to identify in regards to whether or not the collapse of the American empire is imminent or not is the extent of public division. Of that, of course, ties in really well with this whole domestic terror discussion, because it's obviously been used even more as a wedge to divide the public in the U.S. even more than it was over COVID or things that even preceded, you know, COVID-19 and all of that. So, how does this division play into the collapse of American empire? And what do you think have been some of the biggest events in manufacturing it, both recently and historically?
Oh, yeah. The division of the public is paramount to this, to the collapse. Because, and frankly, that's an operation they've been running on us for a very long time. Keep us divided. Red team, blue team, rich versus poor, black and white, geographical areas, you name it. If there's a way to divide us into smaller and smaller groups, they'll do that. But what we've seen in the last 2 years has been a massive acceleration. The division of the public, that wealth inequality that's happening in this situation, that, you know, we hear these statistics of, you know, the three richest people in America have more wealth than the bottom 50%. This is another form of division. It's economic division. And it works to create almost like a two-tiered system. You already see that in the legal system, for sure. I mean, the rich have one set of rules for them and the poor have another. And so we look at these things. These are signs that you are in a society that is decaying. And it's tough to come back from this unless you get very honest about who is the problem here, who's running this show, who's trying to divide you. And it's the mainstream media is at the forefront of this, and social media too, to an extent. But the mainstream media creates these narratives, they shape reality, and they create a division of the public. They get people fighting. All you have to do is just flip from one cable news channel to the other and see how things are being played out. And you can take the same event and have it sound very different depending on which audience is watching. So they've got, you know, if you're, you know, watching MSNBC and CNN and you talk about the Capitol situation on January 6th, it's, oh my God, it's the new 9/11. This cannot stand. This is the destruction of our democracy. It's a blah, blah, blah. I mean, they couldn't sell it any harder.
Yeah.
But for people on the other side, they saw it as, this looks like a bunch of LARPing retards out there dressed up in costumes. This doesn't seem like anything real. This is a joke. The cops are, there's a video of cops letting them in. There's massive amounts of professional photographers standing all over the place taking pictures of this. None of this looks real. So it's like, here we go. We're divided into what even reality is at this point. So
yeah,
that works to, you know, if in order to prevent this collapse from happening, you have to come together as a nation of ants against these grasshoppers. Well, they know that, of course. They know that they are the few and we are the many. And the best strategy for keeping us from getting them and dragging them out of their castles is to keep us down on the reservations fighting with each other. And that, of course, is what they've done. And taken it to a scientific level, you know. So for those of us that are fighting against one another, I understand it's frustrating. There's a lot to argue about. But while we're doing that, let's at least carve out a portion of that time to acknowledge that we are being pitted against each other by forces above us that need us to fight. And if we were to put that aside, our petty differences. Just say, I'll get back to arguing with you people on the left and the right later. But for now, let's prioritize our efforts and focus on the real problem, which is the ruling class. If we did that, I think that we would find that after that situation was taken care of, those people that we had arguments with on the left and the right, I think those arguments would be would not be of much interest to us anymore. I think that the real problem is that we're getting controlled by forces far above us. And until we wake up and recognize the game that's being played, the fact we'll never solve it. And to be fair, a large segment of the population, they don't even realize there's a game being played. They have no idea what their role is in this. So it's going to be a tough road. You know, it's going to be a tough road because you have to wake up a bunch of people. And there's an old proverb, an old Navajo proverb, I think it was, that says it is impossible to wake somebody who is pretending to be asleep.
I haven't heard that one before, but that's a really good point. But this whole, you know, division thing is something I've been thinking about a lot in terms of, you know, what can we do to solve it or to combat it? And I keep sort of really just coming back to, you know, it's really an information war in an extent, because a lot of this division is, you know, based on different perceptions, like you were saying. I mean, they've basically become different realities. And, you know, if it is the case that the best way to solve it is through information, you know, then obviously, you know, it becomes a responsibility specifically of independent media, because, you know, the propaganda organs of the state or mainstream media, you know, their content that comes out is one of the biggest factors in manufacturing this division, in my opinion, you know, with January 6th, you know, how they use that to divide people and create those different realities based, you know, where there's this fact-based narrative. You know, that you and I would, you know, you cited some of the facts there, the police and all of that. But then there's a separate narrative, this emotion-based narrative, like, you know, AOC was almost murdered and all of this stuff, despite the fact that she was in a different building and all of this stuff, you know, but people become emotionally invested in it and then the facts don't matter. You know, a lot of that has to do with mainstream media, but, you know, I keep seeing so many people in independent media being just as divided, if not more, than the public. And it really, you know, makes you wonder, you know, about you know, the best ways to combat this. So I didn't want to sound too doom and gloomy there, because obviously, you know, there is an impact to be made by people like you and me and other, you know, others with integrity in independent media. But, you know, increasingly it seems like, and it's very possible there's like psyops of this effect to drum it up in independent media. But I feel like a lot of outlets have increasingly, you know, dropped the ball.
I think so. And it's a shame. And you mentioned not sounding too doom and gloom. I'd like to not sound that way as well. So I'll take this opportunity to say that, look, the game is not over yet.
Right.
We have an opportunity for this whole thing to turn around, but it requires us to acknowledge that we have been played, and that's a tough thing to, you know, that we've been lied to, and that is psychologically, it's a difficult thing for us to come to terms with. But we need to grow up and we need to get over this. But because if we do recognize what has happened, and the alternative media is going to have to play a better role in this of really waking people up with facts. You know, the mainstream media preys on emotion. they get, you know, facts don't even matter to them. They want you to feel a certain way. The mainstream media has done that for a long, long time. The alternative media has tried to combat emotion with facts. And that will work for some people, but it will not work for everybody. I think until you get the American public emotionally angry at the government for this, then things will start to change. But if we're trying to combat them, I mean, I can roll out COVID statistics all day long from the CDC and and destroy their own argument with their own numbers. So the alternative media has been really good at dealing with the facts of the case, whereas the mainstream media focuses on the emotions of these stories. They want to make you feel a certain way, whereas the alternative media wants to give you the facts and debunk things. So until we get to a point where the alternative media can emotionally connect with the readers, can get them to feel this frustration and this pain, and it beyond just fact checking these liars in the mainstream media, we've got to do a better job of getting people angry to the point where they're going to want to do something about it. Maybe angry is not the right word, but just, you know, understanding the current situation so well that it gives them no choice but to be frustrated. And then that is the first step towards actually doing something about it. Where we've been in the United States for the last 20 years or so is just, we've all just been passive observers of this.
Yeah.
We're not very good at protesting or riot, you know, or any of those things. I mean, our protests turn into riots and they're co-opted, you know, to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to have to fight this battle on two levels. We're going to have to deal with the massive, never-ending lies of the mainstream media trying to craft a narrative or a view of the world that creates this anger and resentment in whoever's watching their program. And we're going to have to counteract that by getting people, you know, giving them the facts and then getting them to emotionally get invested in trying to change these things. But where we've been recently, you know, fighting the mainstream media, boy, it's tough because they're so pervasive and so many normie people just depend on them for their news and they don't even check to see if they think that, you know, if there's any truth to it. And that's a dangerous place to be. So if we do our job right and we expose the mainstream media for being the pathological liars that they are, that is one step closer to getting the public to start looking for different versions of information. If they know that they can't trust the mainstream media, which they should know, but they don't, then the next step is, okay, well then where do I go for information? And it's like, well, let me show you there's some other outlets out there. And just because the guy telling you this information isn't wearing a suit and tie and sitting in a, you know, collecting a $9 million a year salary, it doesn't make his information any less valid. In fact, quite the contrary, it might make his information less compromised because he's not being paid millions of dollars to deliver it. So a pushback towards this, you know, towards real journalism, boy, we need it now more than ever.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that assessment. And I think you brought up some good points that we really need to try and stress to people how high the stakes are so that they become emotionally invested in the outcomes and don't remain passive observers while we're facing things like the Great Reset and you know, these types of, you know, events that are clearly coming, you know, down the pike. And I really hope that more people become receptive to that. But, you know, what's interesting too is that I think, at least in independent media, there are some people also that are afraid to speak up about these more recently contentious issues, whether it's this domestic terror effort or COVID or something to that effect. And I think a lot of that is because these people are invested sort of in it for, you know, as a career, as opposed to, you know, they're just here because they want to get information out. You know, there's usually there's some people that are mixes of those two things, not necessarily, you know, a black and white thing. But I think to people that are motivated by a large degree by careerism at this point, I think are unaware just how journalism in the world of the Great Reset is set to change. You know, you have Google, for example. I believe they're doing this in Turkey, doing a pilot study to basically replace journalists at you know, the state-run Turkish media outlet with AI. and have algorithms write the news, because, you know, you can train the AI, like, this is the syntax used in an intro, and basically teach them the grammatical structures, train them on millions of mainstream media news articles, and have them bust it out. You know, and so obviously, you know, whether you're a careerist in mainstream media or independent media, you know, it doesn't really matter, because these people don't really, despite all their public talk of, oh, we need to protect journalism and the integrity of journalism and truth and all this stuff, the fact checkers and what have you. I mean, the people that fund them are planning to replace them all with robots and artificial intelligence. So I think, you know, maybe... if you have contact with any of those people, those listening independent people, or maybe you know someone in your family that happens to be in mainstream media, for example, you know, I think it's worth stressing that, you know, we are really at a critical juncture, and that careerism is not really a valid motivation at this point, given what we're facing, because, you know, you'll be preserving your career perhaps for a couple months tops.
I remember seeing China roll out a video of an AI news anchor. And they were so proud of it. They said this was the first robotic news anchor. And I put it on Twitter. I said, how dare you? We were the first to have soulless robot news readers in the United States. And now you're rolling out this AI.
Wolf Blitzer,
you're
going to compete
with Anderson Cooper. I mean, listen, we have a monopoly on robot news readers out here in the U.S. And you know, to be fair to the alternative media, too, you have to make a calculation on this, you know, whether if you're going to talk about some of these important stories, and you should, if you know the game and you know what is possible, you do have to realize that there's going to be backlash. I mean, there always was, but as you said, moving into this new fourth industrial revolution version of the world with, you know, the role of reporters and things like that, there will be, if you go hard against these people, they will come back for you. So you have to calculate that too. So that, like you said, it's the decision. Are you in this for a career, or are you in this to really get the news and information out? And this will separate some people, you know, who wants to talk about this stuff and put a big target on their heads.
Yeah. I think it already has separated people.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, we see deplatforming. We've seen worse than that with regard to the people in the vaccine whistleblowers that turn up DEAD sometimes, you know, after going hard in the paint, as Sam Tripoli likes to say, on these topics, because you are getting very close to something that the powers that be do not want you talking about. And so there's repercussions for that. And so we have to be brave and strategic and smart and careful and all of those things. But we also have to remember what's important. And that is, if we don't stand up for these sorts of things now, we're going to get to a point where we can't. There's no, you can't do it from inside the cell. You know, you're stuck. So I hate to be so, you know, dramatic about it, but it is the reality of this situation, is that we are watching the walls of the digital prison be built right in front of our eyes. And if we don't stand up now, we might get to a point where we never can.
Yeah, absolutely. Great point. Well, that's probably a great place to end it. You know, a very, very relevant call to action. And I really hope that people listening realize, like, even if you don't have a platform, much of a following on social media, there is so much you can do to get this information out, whether it's like guerrilla printing of news articles, or like putting, like, you know, stickers that promote your favorite independent media site somewhere in town or whatever, or emailing it to your friends and family. You know, there's so much that can be done and that needs to be done in order to try and change, you know, turn the tide in terms of like the information component of this, you know, what's really a war in a lot of senses. You know, the state uses, you know, this sort of wartime terminology for a lot of things recently, you know, the war on domestic terror, also COVID being described as like a war, you know, oftentimes. I mean, we really are in something that is a battle in at least a sense, you know, maybe not like in the traditional sense that you would think of, but there definitely is a fight taking place. And it's really, you know, incumbent on all of us to take some sort of stand. And, you know, even if you don't think you have a lot of power to affect change, you probably do. So
With that being said, thanks so much, Charlie, for joining us today, and catch you all next time on the next episode of Unlimited Hangout.